All right. Well, welcome to the Happiness Health Connection. And what we're going to talk about today is how your immune system and therefore your health changes radically and sometimes immediately with changes of emotional well-being. And so as we're getting started here, I just want to ask if anyone on the line has ever seen a cause and effect between maybe being upset and getting a cold or even getting the flu, or it doesn't have to be upset. When I say upset, that covers a wide range, everything from fear to anxiety to anger to grieving to panic to frustration, to reaction to something that leaves you shaking. All of those things are typically not in the realm of well-being. And so I just want to ask you if you have ever noticed that it impacts you when you feel bad emotionally. And if so, a time that you can remember that it did.
It always affects, and I always notice it.
And what have you seen happen? What kind of emotion might you have had, and what kind of a physical response?
Well, like right now, I've been sick for days because of stress and knowing that that was it, that I got run down.
Okay.
As I get older, I have to be more careful of how my emotions affect my health.
Okay. But you're associating age with it. And in fact, researchers are saying age has nothing to do with it. It happens to us
yeah.
Whether we're 17 or 37 or 87.
My ability to recover from partying isn't as good. It takes longer.
Well, I would say
My health?
That is something a little bit different because alcohol has always been shown to lower your resistance. That's always true.
So it was my diet.
Yeah. Yeah, then I said we weren't going to talk about food, but maybe I will anyway.
It's always on my mind today.
When I'm stressed, I don't sleep well. I may be able to get to sleep, but I can't stay asleep. Or I wake up much earlier than I need to. Result being I'm tired when I wake up, and then I'm sort of grouchy. This hasn't happened to me, but I have a good friend who a few months ago came down with an absolutely awful cold, and she hadn't had a cold for like 3-4 years. And she also felt that she had a touch of hay fever. And finally, someone pointed out that there was something that she had been doing that she was very fearful of. And when she finally acknowledged her fear, the next day she woke up and the cold was almost totally gone.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, that sounds like what I'm really going through. That's the truth, because I'm going through a lot of fear, stress stuff at a major level. All my battles have reached their peaks. And I have a cold that I haven't had for a long time. I mean, I haven't been this kicked out for a long, long time. And so it is, I did see stress, but... And as it gets better, I have moments where it's better when I feel like I'm winning, you know. And then there's moments I don't feel like I'm winning, I guess, you know. So that's very interesting about your friend. That makes sense.
It does. And it makes sense because what the research is showing is that your body responds very, very, very quickly to a relief factor. And a relief factor could be like her friend who said, oh, I've been feeling fearful. Well, the minute that you can step back from your emotions and observe yourself, you're not at all as entangled in them. And so even that goes that's the same thing for stress, is that if you can step back from it and say, wow, I'm pretty stressed right now, and make a conscious decision to do something to lower that stress, that can help tremendously. Or even saying, oh, okay, I guess I'm really stressed. I'm going to just try to relax a little bit because that's the best thing I can do since I can't change anything. And this right this red-hot minute, I can't change anything except my attitude, my thoughts, my emotions, my breathing, and maybe I can go take a walk. But there are things that we can do to sidestep the reactions of the body to all of the stress emotions. And let me just say, as we're talking about this, stress is certainly a huge factor for so many families and so many people today because of the state of the economy. And yet we call it stress, but when you think about it, stress can come from any emotion that is not a feeling of well-being. And what's a feeling of well-being? Well, happiness is a sense of feeling okay. And it can go, it's a range of feeling. It can go from feeling okay to feeling absolute bliss. But happiness can be where you're waking up and you have an absence of fear, an absence of frustration, an absence of whatever it was that was causing you alarm the day before. If you wake up without having that sensation, or you somehow have conquered it because you got a viewpoint on it that set you apart from it, and you were able to step back and be the observer of yourself, it completely lessens the impact of it. Mm-hmm. And so that certainly is a method that we can use. But what I want to talk about, and if you feel more comfortable muting yourselves right now, I'm going to come back and we'll talk some more at the end, but I want to just talk a little about the history of this and how it has become much more mainstream, and certainly we have more and more research that tells us that we are on the right track when we're very aware of our emotions. So let me just, you can do that. You can mute by pressing *6 if you want to. If you don't, that's fine too, because I think it's fairly quiet. But here is a little bit of the background, and let's just say that as a base note for everything, as just a starting point, we do accept today in fairly mainstream understanding that the greater sense of well-being we have, the stronger our immune system will be, and therefore the healthier we will be, because there's no question that we live in a sea of germs. I mean, you know, there isn't any place we're going to go that there aren't viruses and bacteria and pollens and every other kind of thing that could bother us. But when we're in a state of wonderful immune, an immune system that is fully functioning, we are able to fight off everything, truly everything, including cancer. And that makes sense because there are people that live to be 116 who have smoked and drank their entire lives. Not that I'm recommending either one of those things, but it's an interesting thing that the woman in France who was 116 when she died, and there was nothing infirm about her. There wasn't any kind of mental disability or dementia or anything. She was strong and healthy. And she died in her sleep at 116. And I think that would be nice for all of us to live fully functioning and powerful until the last minute we're here and then and disappear while we're sleeping. Isn't that really, really a wonderful image to have? Well, you probably aren't going to find too many traditional MDs, too many traditional doctors who would understand this clearly, because it isn't yet taught in very many medical schools. But it will be. Trust me that in the next 20 years, there's going to be a lot of MDs that are very aware of it. And there are many now that are aware of it, but it certainly isn't something he would talk about with another doctor, for example, or she would talk about with another doctor. But there is more and more research showing us that the relationship between people who are happy and satisfied with their lives and people who are healthier than the general population is a very, very clear relationship. And not only do improvements happen, even overnight, just like the friend that started getting over her cold the very next morning. And some people would say, oh, well, it was a virus and it came to the end of the virus. No, I don't believe that at all. I think that even if there is a virus, there are people that have a very mild reaction to a virus because they have a healthy immune system, and there are other people who are absolutely clobbered by the very same virus. And what they've discovered as well in research that's been happening through the Mellon Institute and other research facilities is that people who have had a history of getting colds, for example, or having a lowered immune system, people who are determined to change their reactions to life, that's really what being happy is about, how you react to your bank statement, how you react to what someone says to you, how you react to an obstacle that's facing you, or a challenge that's facing you, or something that has just come up that you totally did not expect, how do you react to it? That's what life is all about. That's what emotional intelligence is all about. But what the researchers are finding is that people who were actually in ill health and had been for many years could turn around their natural response physically to all of the allergens, to all of the viruses and bacteria, and 3 years after they made a decision to begin acting as if there's solutions to everything, responding in a way that says, I can handle this, I can make something better happen from this, or if it's nothing I can change or alter, that I can deal with it and relax with it till I get through it. Those people showed a complete change in their immune responses in a 3-year period of time and less. So I think that this is a really important understanding for us to have. And the beginning of it, just as a note of history here, I definitely want you to know that there was a doctor, he was an MD, he was a professor of physiology at Harvard University. Way back in 1911 and 1912, started working with animals. His name was Walter Cannon. He started working with animals, and he observed that any change of emotional state in an animal, such as anxiety, distress, rage, or other emotions that he could easily perceive because it was an animal, was also accompanied by a total cessation of movement in the stomach. So when we know that ulcers are very often caused by stress, we say it's caused by stress, and stress can be fear, it can be anger, it can be distress, it can be rage, it can be frustration. Well, when we see that there's a total ceasing of movement of the stomach, we understand how that in turn can have an effect of bothering your total digestive system. And when we call fight or flight response to stress, there is also another response that has been cataloged and talked about more recently called the freeze response. And the freeze response basically is your stomach doesn't process food. It doesn't function in any way. And that's why when families sit around a table and yell and argue, those families that do, it's the worst thing they can do because you cannot digest. You can't, the stomach juices entirely stop working on the food. And so way back in 1911, his paper was called The Mechanical Factors of Digestion. And then in 1915, he wrote a work that was very much republished again and again called Bodily Changes in Pain, Hunger, fear, and rage. And so we see that the body causes changes to happen that we don't feel like we're in control of. But in fact, we are in control of them, because what creates fear, what creates rage, what creates distress of any kind is a thought. And a thought is something at the beginning of the whole process that generally says, I can't control this, and it's going to last forever, and I am totally at the mercy of it. And those kinds of responses then sound and feel like victimhood, and we have those responses when we feel that there isn't anything we can do about it, or that we're at the mercy of that, that something that is controlling us. So after that work was done, the most major jump forward happened about four decades later with the work of Dr. Hans Selye. And Dr. Selye was the first MD that actually coined the word and talked about it, the word stress. We really didn't talk about it before that. And so what he called this, he said that when you put animals under physical and mental adverse conditions, maybe being hungry, maybe being in an enclosed space, maybe being tied up and you cannot move, he noticed that the conditions of the body consistently adapted to heal and recover. And after years of experimentation, he called the response that we have in the body the general adaptation syndrome. And what happens in the body as a response to stress is something that is now easily trackable. But back when he started doing this, it wasn't very trackable. One of the things that he discovered happens in the face of stress is that the adrenal gland enlarges. And why does it enlarge? Because it is pumping out adrenaline repeatedly, pumping, 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 pumping. And we have an atrophy of the thymus gland. Now, I have spoken earlier in other seminars about what happens when we become stressed. And one of the things that happens, as we have found out even as early as 1916 from the battlefields in World War I, it was discovered that people under a huge amount of stress have the thymus gland, which is really the seat of immunity, the thymus gland, which is located just below the notch in your collarbone and behind the bone plate that is just below that notch in your collarbone. It's the thymus gland, not the thyroid gland, but the thymus gland. And the thymus gland is supposed to be about the size of an apricot. Well, it was found that in people who were on the battlefield in a high, high stress state, that thymus gland, which was responsible for sending out the natural killer cells and sending out the messengers that said, hey, take care of the foot, it's got an infection in it. The thymus gland, instead of expanding to take care of the situation, the thymus gland actually was shrinking. And it would shrink down to the size of a peanut. Instead of being the size of an apricot, picture the size of a peanut. And therefore, it was hardly putting out any fighter cells to protect the body. And the cells it was putting out were moving at a very, very slow rate. The natural killer cells were not rushing to the scene of the accident. They were walking, and they were shuffling slowly there. So what we also found, besides the atrophy of the thymus, is that the spleen was atrophying. And the spleen is another function in our body, another vital organ that helps protect the body and works to send out natural killer cells. And it also affected the lymphatic tissue, which helps to purge the body of toxins. The whole body, your entire body has lymph glands all the way through it. And what it does is constantly clean out the water that makes up what most of us are composed of. Our bodies are composed of approximately 92% water. And so what the lymph glands do is they filter out the impurities in the body. Well, in the sense of the time when we are feeling under stress, under attack, or feeling that we're under adverse conditions, that lymph tissue is not functioning and not doing its job the way it should. And so, of course, things can go wrong with the lymphatic tissue. And then finally, the last thing that Hans Selye observed was that gastric ulcerations increased. And that's not any surprise, gastric meaning the stomach and everything having to do with the lining of the stomach and probably the beginning of the small intestine at least. Just that whole digestive tract was in distress. Because when you stop digesting and food is sitting there, you're in big trouble. Because it sits there and it does nothing but ferment. And that sounds bad, and it is. So what Hans Selye talked about is that there are three stages of adaptation when you get stressed. And the first one, it's an initial brief alarm reaction. And if you go into an alarm reaction and come out of it, you'll have a short burst of adrenaline and cortisol, and then you come out of it, and it charges up your body, and it helps you actually react to it better. And then you get over it, and it actually can do some good for your body. That is called good stress. But when you have an alarm reaction, or a slowly building alarm reaction, and then you stay in stress, Hans Selye called that the resistance stage, where you're constantly feeling stressed, where you are, it's just this low buzz going on all the time, or maybe a high-pitched buzz going on all the time of stress. Well, if you're feeling tense, if you're feeling anxious, if you're feeling frustrated or fearful or any of those emotions, you're obviously not feeling happy. And so in that stage of resistance, you are really, truly using up a lot of your body's supplies, and you're using up a lot of your body's, a lot of researchers have said, you are using up even the vitamins and minerals of your body, that in fact, when you are stressed, you are using up your supply of vitamin C faster than you do when you are not stressed. And that's why I always suggest you take extra vitamin C, and certainly because that's one thing your body does not produce in any kind of large amounts, and what we know really, truly protects the body is vitamin C. And, of course, my recommendation is that you take ester C, not just any old kind of vitamin C, but ester C, to help protect the body. But if you don't have ester C, then take any kind of vitamin C just to keep vitamin C in your body. But the regular kind of vitamin C, the acidic form of vitamin C, is gone from your bodily system in 3 to 4 hours. So you really, really want to keep supplying it to your body, especially when you're sick. You want to take, in fact, if you feel like you're coming down with something, you want to take vitamin C every hour on the hour. That's the best thing you could do for yourself to protect your body. And then you reach a point where you get gastric distress if you're not taking ester C, and you may have diarrhea. But in fact, it's a very good thing to end up with, because then you say, okay, I have just done a vitamin C flush of my body. I've taken all the vitamin C I can handle, and now I'll step back a little bit. But let's just say we are now having the benefit of the researchers in the past who have discovered all of these things, that one thing after another, in 1975, huge steps were made forward with Dr. Robert Ader and Nicholas Cohen at the University of Rochester, when they discovered that if you've been upset before about it from a particular person or from an event that is similar to an event that continues to happen, that you are conditioned, just like Pavlov's dog, when they rang a bell and Pavlov's dog salivated, that, for example, unless you arm yourself in advance to not react to a person that you might have, that you might feel stressful around, unless you prepare yourself in advance and determine that you're not going to react that way, your body, in fact, reacts exactly the same way it reacted before. And truly, it's your job to help your body so that you don't go into that reactive state, so that you arm yourself in advance. so that you don't have all of these different things happening to your body that are detrimental to your body. Well, in 1981, Dr. David Felton, who was working at the Indiana University of Medicine, discovered something really important, and that is that we have nerves that directly lead to blood vessels. In other words, they didn't know that before. They thought the nervous system was somewhat separate from the blood system, from the circulatory system. But they found that these nerves terminated at blood vessels. So immediately when the nerves reacted to an emotion, it could make your blood vessels squeeze tighter and get smaller, or relax and open up and let more blood flow through. And so we know that in a split second, our face can get beet red with embarrassment or anger, or in a split second, we can shut down our circulation to the point that it's extremely dangerous for us. They also discovered in this research, Dr. David Felton discovered, that nerves led also to cells of the immune system, that nerves were sitting right next to cells that were sending signals directly to your immune system. And so now it begins to really make sense why emotions, which create a nerve reaction, why emotions affect your immune system so strongly. They also found that these nerves terminated near the thymus and near the spleen and near clusters of lymphocytes and near other groups of cells that are protective cells, somewhat like the natural killer cells. They all help control the immune function. So this all terminated in a wonderful book called Psychoneuroimmunology that was written in 1981. So although the term psychoneuroimmunology is not known very much to the general public, it's been a term that I've only known about for about 12 years, but certainly this book was written on longer than 12 years ago. There have been so many other good, excellent works that have been written to teach us more about this in layman's terms. But that is really the study of what I'm talking about. Psychoneuroimmunology. In other words, the mind, the nerves, and how that affects your immune system. So that's really the backdrop for everything. And what we know also from the research that's been done recently is that we have so many natural functions of our bodies that jump in to help us and take care of problematic situations in the body. So many things that the pharmaceutical companies have tried to replicate in their labs that can help people, for example, fight cancer. For example, interleukin-2 and interleukin-6. There are other interleukins, but our bodies naturally create interleukin-2 and interleukin-6, but you can buy interleukin-2 from many of the huge pharmaceutical companies, and that is used to help certain types of cancer. But when we are in a wonderful state of feeling, we create interleukin-2. In fact, when we are experiencing a state of bliss or a state where we are laughing and feeling really joyful, a state where we're feeling just delighted with something, we create interleukin-2. Now, when you think about this, ask yourself, if it costs me absolutely nothing to laugh, and in my laughter, in my feeling good, I am creating a natural drug that is fighting all kinds of issues in my body, including any cancer cells I might have going on in my body at the moment, because we all create malformed or even cancerous cells every day, and every day our body cleans them up. If you're at a point where just by laughing you say, there's so many problems and I can't fix them and I don't know what to do about it, then I say, find a way to laugh. Find a way to feel silly blissful for a little while, for even a few minutes. A man named Norman Cousins was a guy who was the editor of the Saturday Review many, many years ago. And he went on a trip to Russia. And while he was there, he feels that it was while he was there, he contracted a nerve disease. He came back to the U.S., and he was told by doctors here that he had an incurable nerve condition that we knew little about. We didn't have any medication to help it, and they knew it was extremely painful. But they also knew that if he took anything to suppress the pain, it would cause him to die faster, that even aspirin would cause it to become worse very, very, very quickly. He went to several doctors and got second and third and fourth opinions, and they all turned out to be the same thing. Well, knowing that he was going to die and feeling that there really wasn't much he could do about it, he didn't want to give this disease to his wife, since he didn't know if it was, he didn't know if it was contagious, he didn't know how he had gotten it in the first place. So he checked himself into a hotel, and he asked that his wife, this is back in the days of videotapes, he asked that his wife would deliver to him videotapes of anything that might make him laugh, any funny movie and any funny old series or anything, from the Keystone Cops to the Three Stooges to MASH to anything that would just be something that he could chuckle at. Because he needed to get his mind off of his concerns. He couldn't work. He was afraid he was contagious. He was in pain. He couldn't do anything. So he went and camped out in this hotel room. Well, he discovered something really interesting. He found that when he could laugh for about 20 minutes, just by watching a MASH rerun for 22 minutes, he could be pain-free for about 45 minutes to an hour. And as he started watching more of these reruns of different things that made him laugh, he started feeling better. And he discovered that those minutes that he was laughing started having a bigger and bigger response time of feeling medicated, of feeling calm, and of feeling completely free of pain, so that after a while, his 22 minutes of laughing gave him about 2 hours free of pain. And he started noticing that things were changing with him, that he could sleep for longer periods, that he felt better overall, that he had more energy. So he kept watching movies. His wife kept dropping off more of these at his door. He kept just going through these tapes, but seeing them again and again and again, and allowing himself to just simply get involved with it and laugh. After 3 months of this, he asked a doctor to come back and take blood and examine him. The doctor took blood, left, came back, and reported to him, "I no longer see any signs of illness." He was completely healed, completely cured. And what cured him? Well, was it laughter? He spent many years following that, working with a team at UCLA trying to research laughter, and unfortunately, they never were able to come up with a definitive treatise on what they had discovered, partly because I imagine that some people would laugh without really feeling it. They'd laugh without really having it hit their true funny bone. They would think, okay, this is about being tested for laughter, so I'll laugh. If we all could find ways to ease our tension and laugh, I believe that if we could shake up the body a little bit, like with this internal jogging, we would then have a footing to start noticing other things that are feeling okay and feeling good, which is what we have to do. A happy person is a person that can shift their mind at will to focus on what is going right. And that's how you get your body to function better and start producing more of the things that we can produce, because when that brain and the nerve system, the nervous system, talk to the immune system, the brain actually starts processing everything that it's needed to start recovering from whatever is wrong. Even if we don't even know that something is developing in our bodies, cancer doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. And I believe then, if it takes time to have, say, a lump form or a tumor form or something to go wrong in the lymphatic system, if it takes time having this at a lower level of stress, and maybe we don't even realize what's going on, if we knew that if all it took was a daily dose of laughter, maybe if you've been stressed a long time, it might take 2 daily doses of laughter. But it doesn't cost anything, and it could potentially avoid thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of medications later on, and maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars of hospitalization. We really can't allow ourselves to remain in a stress state unbroken. And how can we change what's happening in our nervous system to help it get relief? Our job really is to help yourself to lift out of it, even if you lift out of it for 10 or 20 minutes at a time. It is your job to help yourself do this. Nobody else can do it for you. Nobody else's version of what's funny can even work.
Yeah. It goes on for an hour. It's like so hard to hold. But I'm on mute, so they can't hear me.
Oh, yes, I can.
I'm walking around listening.
I can hear you.
Oh, okay.
So you're not on mute.
I haven't seen you for a long time.
Yeah, I know.
Just last weekend, I think.
You're not on mute. Can you put on star 6? Can you put it on star
6? Oh, got it. You ready to talk to me. Star
6. So anyway, what I definitely, talking about the happiness-health connection, the studies that have come about in the last 10 years are showing us that people who are able to step back from whatever they're feeling and see themselves as sort of from a distance, having that objective viewpoint by saying, look, I want to change how I'm feeling. I don't like how I'm feeling. I'm going to change how I'm feeling. That is having an awareness level that we all need to develop. So in addition to learning how to laugh and deliberately making yourself laugh, some of the other things that we can do is use the tool that's called mindfulness. Now, meditation is different from mindfulness. Mindfulness is a new form of something like meditation, but it's not meditation. It is observing how you are feeling and how you are reacting at any moment in time. So that if you are responding to something with fear, or you're being uncomfortable with something, or you are finding yourself feeling distressed in the presence of someone, that you start observing that and saying, oh, I don't like the way I'm feeling, and I am choosing to change this because I don't want to create a surge of adrenaline through my system or a surge of cortisol through my system, which is going to diminish my immune response. I am choosing to feel differently, or I am choosing to react differently. Instead of saying, oh, this is a real problem, or oh boy, here it goes, here it starts again, and having that kind of a feeling of inevitable sarcasm sort of over things happening, to say something like, I'm aware of this, I know that that's my norm is to react as if I can't handle this, and I choose to stop doing it that way. I choose to be a different person. I choose to say, yes, this is a problem, but I can't do anything about it today. And so I choose to let go of it in my mind. I choose to, and we've heard the phrase let go and let God, and that used to really tick me off. But for many, many people, that is the only answer today. That's the only answer in the moment, is to say, I release it, and I let it go. To just say, I try to relax. I consciously choose to loosen up. And for some people, the word relax, when you're a type A or when you're extremely stressed, to say to somebody, relax, will just make you shoot out of your seat and scream. So what you need to do instead is to say, loosen up, shake your hands out. But coming back to the topic of mindfulness, mindfulness means observing yourself and understanding yourself and not acquiescing to saying, oh, I'm really stressed and I know I'm stressed and leave it at that, but to say, I'm really stressed and I'm choosing to change that right now. Wow, I really got myself wound up and now I'm going to do something about that. I am going to deliberately breathe to a count of 10. I'm going to deliberately breathe in to a count of 10 and breathe out to a count of 10. Breathing is another fast, simple, quick way to immediately change your immune function, because your breathing, when you get control of your breathing, you get control of your mind. And when you get control of your mind, you get control of your emotions. So deliberate breathing is a reaction, can be a chosen reaction to what you have discovered in your journey of mindfulness when you've stepped back and observed yourself and you have said, wow, this is really, really interesting. I can't believe I get this tense from this every single morning. Well, I am not going to do that anymore. So mindfulness awareness practice, there's many of them, actually, and it's certainly stepping back and watching yourself. Another kind of what might fall under mindfulness but is really in its own category is meditation. Meditation means that you decide to focus on something and get your mind off everything else, and that might be started by doing a couple of things. One of the ways that I help myself get into meditation is by putting my attention on my breath, on my breathing. And so when I do that, it causes my brain to have to focus on one thing. When you're stressed, your brain is bip-bopping around. Your brain is hopping from one distress to another distress to another distress to another distress, and it is your job to calm it down. So let's just say that you are very stressed. Let's take an example. Let's say you're stressed and you're irritated and you can't seem to calm yourself down and you'd like to meditate, but you can't because you can't get yourself in that position. Meditating meaning getting your mind clear for a period of time, even 3 to 5 minutes. So the first thing you want to do is notice it, which you have. You say, wow, look at this. I'm bit-bopping around. I'm flitting, and that means I'm flitting from one stress to another and it doesn't feel good. None of it feels good. So then the first thing you might do is count to 10 on the inhalation. So you inhale while you count to 10 and you exhale while you count to 10. And you do it again more slowly. And you do it again more slowly. And from there, you move into the beginning stages of meditation where you say, okay, I'm going to follow my breathing with my mind, and that's all I'm going to think about. I am going to pay attention to the fact that I'm not breathing myself. Something bigger than me is breathing me. You could say it's my autonomic nervous system that's breathing me. Or you could say God is breathing me, and I'm going to follow my breath, watching my breath flow in and focus on it, and watching my breath flow out. Now, for those of you who wake up in the middle of the night, or for those of you who wake up too early in the morning, I cannot recommend this one little technique highly enough. get enough control over yourself. And I know it takes a lot of effort in the middle of the night and early in the morning, but tell yourself, I'm going to watch my breath flow in and watch my breath flow out. I am going to feel like there's a speck of dust in that breath, and I am going to watch it come into my lungs and watch it flow back out of my lungs all the way up and out through my nose or my mouth. Then I'm going to watch my breath flow in again, all the way down, and watch it come all the way back up out of my lungs, out through my mouth, through my nose. And amazingly enough, that little process all by itself can help you enough to get back to sleep. Well, if you do it during the middle of the day, that little calming exercise, getting a little bit of meditation, just a little bit goes a long way, so that then you can say, look, I'm fine right now. I have a roof over my head. I'm paying my bills. I've got food in my cupboard. I'm cool enough. I'm warm enough. I can get from place to place. I really am okay right now. I am fine. And when you calm yourself down to that point, the beginnings of happiness start. And then you say to yourself, if I am doing fine right now and I am calm, now I can release my mind to think about creative ways that I can improve my situation. I'm going to tell myself I can handle this and I can make this better. And as I think about how I can handle it and make this better, I feel stronger and more sure, and then stronger still and more sure, that I can make this be the way I want it to be, that I can handle my life the way I want to handle it. And when you start making this a habit of responding to your life in a way that says, I can handle this, I can take care of this, and also deciding that some reactions, some irritations, whether it's a response to a person or a thing or an event, deciding that those responses and that energy you're giving to it is just not worth trading your health for, now you're on a better platform of deciding how healthy you're going to be. Because moment by moment you are seeing, oh, I'm reacting to the way she just spoke to me. It is not worth it to give her that much energy. I feel that I want to stay healthy. I know I want to stay healthy. And giving that person my energy that I need to fight off anything I need to fight off and to even get super healthy is just not on my agenda anymore. I choose not to judge anybody. I choose not to become irritated by anybody. I choose not to look at people cross-eyed or worry about it if they look at me cross-eyed, because I can either choose to be healthy or choose not to be healthy, because there is a direct correlation between how calm and how joyful and how happy I allow myself to become, even in the face of problems, and how healthy I am. Now, there is a resource center called the Mindful Awareness Research Center that is conducting experiments to find out if children who do mindfulness exercise can improve their ability to choose how they feel, whether that is planning and organizing or avoiding situations or distracting yourself, like I am certainly suggesting. There's also some other tools that I absolutely recommend, and one is yoga. When you practice yoga, it doesn't matter what level you're at, or how far you can bend, it just doesn't matter. If you are comfortable while you're doing it and not having this inner dialogue going on of, oh, I can't do this, oh, I bet I look stupid, oh, I bet I... If you cut down and cut out the inner dialogue that isn't helpful, yoga can do wonders for you as far as helping you reach a state of relaxation to the point that you feel blissful without even realizing why. And you can stay in that blissful state for somewhere from 24 to 48 hours. There's also Tai Chi, which is what is often practiced in China. When I was in Hong Kong, I saw a park early in the morning where there were probably 400 or 500 people, most of them elderly, doing Tai Chi, this beautiful, slow movement that's like yoga. It's like a practice that is so soothing and calming. I think we all need to learn it. And then, of course, there's another place that the Norman Cousins' legacy is the Cousins Center, where they research all of the things that we can do to help us function better. And certainly UCLA continues their work on this. The Cousins Center has actually led the way in demonstrating that the practice of mindfulness has an incredible variety of positive benefits, from improving sleep, sleeping deeper, sleeping longer, and reducing pain, to enhancing the potency of vaccines and increasing all the killer cells in the body, even in the HIV patients that they have dealt with. And so when they have studied people that have immune system function problems, like people who have HIV function problems, this is like the extreme where the test is really showing itself whether it works or not. And they're finding that people who have HIV most definitely function better and have their immune system start to perk up, have all of these wonderful things that the body can create all by itself, the chemicals we produce, like the interleukins, that just naturally occur in the body, start ramping up when people practice mindfulness. And a couple of other things to keep in mind. There's also been some wonderful research that shows that music therapy, listening to music, creating your own music, playing music, all has an incredibly powerfully good enhancement of the immune system on the body. Moving to music, as in any kind of dance, also has a powerful, beneficial effect on the body, as well as doing art. All of those things have a beneficial impact on the body. It focuses the mind. It puts us in a state of calm. It puts us in a state of calm that then borders on feeling a sense of well-being that sometimes can even lead to a sense of bliss. And within an instant, your body is functioning better, handling the things it needs to fight better. So now I have come to the conclusion of this discussion, and this is basically the beginning point of what we need to understand about how our bodies react to each and every thought we have. I didn't say that at the beginning, but I want to say it now. There is no thought that you have that you do not have an emotional response to. That's the bottom line. Everything in our world has an emotional response. Anything from we're having salmon for lunch, which sounds like it's a pretty not very exciting statement to make, but most people have an emotional reaction to that because they either like it or they don't like it. And you absolutely need to work it out with your system, understanding how you react and how you should react and what's good for you. And so every single thought you think has an impact on how healthy you are. And the happier thoughts you think, the more powerful thoughts of solution-seeking and feeling grateful and feeling a sense of well-being and feeling a sense of being okay and feeling a sense of being safe, those feelings immediately allow your body to produce the natural chemistry we produce that fights viruses and bacteria and cancer and TB and anything else that's out there. So now what I'd like to do is open the line by pressing star 6 for any comment or any question, any observation, any connection you've made with this, or even to say whether this has been helpful to you. So anything that you might want to add to it is also welcomed. I can't hear anything. So just in case it's not happening, The star six will unmute you.
Oh, there.
Okay.
Wow. I think it helps a lot. And
excellent.
Everything. And I'm in a park. I've been walking around. And like when you say, check your breathing, then I breathe, you know, things like that. But all of it is very true. There's different levels for different situations. But it the whole time I'm thinking, oh, this is one that I want to get a tape of, and I know people I want to have hear it.
Yes. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So it's just so very important that people understand that there is no such thing as a stray thought that doesn't affect your body and your health in some way. And I think everybody needs to understand this.
Yeah, I think it's the most important thing there is.
Yeah, it gets to be, especially, I mean, we've heard it said time and time again, your health is your most important possession. And you need to protect that at all costs. Even if people say, you're out of your mind, why aren't you worried about this? And you say, I can't afford to be worried about it. Really, that's the bottom line. I can't afford the medical cost of being worried about it.
Or you have to fix it, try to fix it, yet, you know, maintain a balance.
Yes.
Because you can't just
always
ignore it, you know.
Right. And, you know, there's that creed that comes out of the AA that says, God help me to change the things I can, accept the things I cannot, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think that is the most important statement of all, is the wisdom to know the difference. What things are fixable, what things are not in this moment, because it's, you know, sometimes for this moment it's not fixable, but give me a chance to do some research and to get some people together and do some things, and I might be able to. But for this moment, I might not be able to do anything. But absolutely, you're right. But in the moments when you're not actively doing something positive about it or handling it or trying to help something to change, to then release it. You have to take a holiday from it, even if it's not yet complete. If you have done all that you can do in the moment to do whatever needs to be done to make it better, and it's not there yet, the best thing you can do for yourself is to say, okay, fine, I let go, I let God, I have to believe that it's working and moving forward, and when the time comes for me to be doing something more active, I'll do it. But right now, the best thing I can do is let go or loosen up. Right?
You can try.
Yeah. I think that is so true, and it's taken me far too many years to reach that point. But I have let go of a lot of what I just call crap.
Yeah.
You know, was just making me miserable. And
yeah.
Now I just kind of roll with it. Whatever happens, happens. So be it.
Yeah. And if it's something that you know you could change, you then have to assess, how much energy will it take to change that? Do I want to exert my body energy and my mental energy on that thing, or do I just choose to let it go?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to balance out, too, the big picture. There's short-term, long-term,
yes.
You know. So you have to balance out all of it. Sometimes you have
yes.
to go for it and fight, and then you get the reward later. And you have to, along the way, try to find the giggles. Like, I have a giggle buddy. That's what we call each other. And no matter what's going on, we try to giggle about it. And that is the greatest healing. We've both noticed that. So,
that is excellent. That's an excellent suggestion, to find a giggle buddy.
Yep, someone in your life every day that you can call on to be there, you know. So, yeah, and you do what it, you know, you pick someone that you can giggle with.
Absolutely.
And I think men need to giggle. Men don't get to giggle enough. I don't know, what would they call it, laughing?
Yeah, they'd probably call it laughing. But, you know, they have tracked it. They said that children at age 5 laugh about healthy kids from, you know, when they're not in distress and not from terrible situations. They laugh about 400 to 500 times a day. Adults generally laugh about 12 times a day.
With everything you're saying here and with what you just said there, this really focuses on, like, I like to design a whole little lifestyle world to put out there, and that really focuses on the base level of what the world is about, the little village or whatever, is the focus on how to find a functioning lifestyle where people aren't all stressed, going too fast, too much going on, or hearing all, like, the negative comments of TV and ads and all these things that they don't realize they're listening and affecting them, or like the news and it's all complaining, but not enough of, hey, this could fix it, or this might work. You know, it's more to look at what is an option for healing.
Yeah, exactly. And there isn't. You know, if you could take every piece of news through on the evening news and have a counterpoint, it would be
there you
really
go.
Good.
Yeah, there we go. I think we just solved it. Now
okay.
We need to go, how can we fix all these problems in the next 10 minutes? Let's do an idea of each of those topics. Or at the end of each topic, they have to try to solve something. What made this happen that would have prevented it?
Yeah, you know? Because that is true adulthood. Because that is true emotional intelligence. It's where we would say, oh, that person has real maturity, or that person is really a wisdom person. Well, all of us can have real maturity, and all of us can be wisdom people. And so if we say to ourselves, I'm choosing to be that person now, wherever I am in my life, I don't beat myself up for not having been it somewhere earlier in my life. I say, now I'm choosing to do this. I'm going to walk the earth from now on as a wisdom person, only giving things the energy it deserves and no more than that.
I find out, too, that lately, that all those years I've been going, why am I doing all this stuff? Why do I have to go through that and all that? And then now I'm getting some answers that there were some things I had to do, and I could not have walked strong enough if I hadn't known what it took to have that power and that wisdom. And I had to go through hard lessons, many, many.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have, and I think that then we ripen, and then we end up saying, you know what, if I hadn't gone through that, I wouldn't have that to use in taking care of this situation. Now, if you can reinterpret everything that has happened in your life and call it good, I mean, that is in Timothy in the Bible. It says, call it all a blessing. You know, if you can do that, then you also reduce your stress. But if there's anything in your past that you still hang on to and say, that was a terrible, horrible thing to have happen, and yes, it probably was, but if you could say, because of that, I have learned something that I can share with others and quite possibly help other people, other women, other girls, whatever, you know, anybody. But I experienced that so I could turn around and help someone. If you can turn it into a blessing, you reduce the stress of the past. Because we are just a bundle of past memories, of current situations, and of imagined futures. And if we can turn all three of those time zones into something that we interpret in a better light, we're going to be healthier, and we're just naturally going to feel happier, and we're going to have a better experience here. And hey, why not? It's free!
You know, sometimes we just really forget to laugh at just such simple things. A friend of mine's been doing some writing, and she has a wonderful turn of the phrase. You know, she'll be writing along, and she'll toss in, you know, a few words that just crack me up. And so, you know, I was reading one of her chapters the other day, and I thought, you know, I kept, you know, I had printed it out, and I would write funny, you know, underscore something, and make a note in the margin, funny. So when she stopped by to pick it up, you know, she would be reading all my comments. And so, you know, I would start to laugh before she even had a chance to see what I thought was so funny. And then we would sit there and sort of dissect what it was that made both of us laugh. I mean, she knew it was being funny when she wrote it, and I thought it was just hysterical when I was reading it. Well, it wasn't hysterical, but it was unexpected. I guess that's the best kind of humor to me, is when you're coming across something you weren't expecting and make you laugh.
You need to read a chapter or half a chapter of her things every day. If that's what it does for you, and that's really awesome, because if people's writings can have some funny fun stuff in it, that is just fabulous.
I write pretty well, but my writing is pretty dull. I just don't have that talent, and it is a talent.
It is a talent. It most definitely is a talent. Well, I am going to conclude the recording, but just stay on for a moment, and I will just click off the recording. Hang in there for a minute here. All right.